of bands, earthquakes, and tsunamis by Rabbi Nassim Kamenetsky Shlita, is sponsored by the Torah Umad Lecture Series. Rabbi Kamenetsky, the son of Yaakov Kamenetsky Zitzal, whose 19th yard site was yesterday, and the son-in-law of former Rosh Hashiva, Ritz Rosh Hashiva and Mashgiach, Rav David Lifshitz Zitzal. He's the author, Rabbi Kamenetsky is the author of the much-talked-about book, The Making of a Gadol, and his most recent article, that Aidan Zomerman, appeared in the journal Beis Aharon V'Yisrael. Gives me great honor to introduce tonight's guest speaker, Rav Nassim Kamenetsky Shlita.
First of all, I'd like to thank Menachem for describing my book as merely much talked about. I think if he'd been in Yerushalayim, he would have been banned already. Good Chodesh, everyone. Tonight is Rosh Chodesh. I entered the main Besmedrash building and I saw the signs quoting, didn't say it, whom they were quoting, but the sign read something that my father-in-law, Zichron Livracha, would speak about when Adar arrived. Mishenichnas Adar marbim besimcha, ve'ein simcha ela Torah. I was glad I was greeted by something that my father-in-law said, because it gives me an opportunity to announce publicly that a kollel is being set up in Binyamin, north of Yerushalayim, in Tel Tzion, in my father-in-law's name, Kolel Tehila LeDavid. This is the first public announcement about this Kolel. Because of what my father-in-law said, Mishanichna Sadar, Marbim B'Teira, Marbim B'Simcha Ve'in Simcha L'Teira, I'm going to structure my lecture tonight in the form of a shir. What do I mean? A shir always begins by the Rosh Hashiva presenting some difficulty, and then he goes off into some tangents, giving the audience a chance, giving the Talmidim a chance to mull over his question while they're continuing to listen to the development of his Dvar Torah. So I'm going to start the same way. I'll tell you a Gemara, a difficult Gemara, and then as you digest it, I'll be continuing on to elaborate on the explanation of this difficult Gemara. The Gemara in Bava Basra Daf Ayin Daled Amid Beis says the following: when God wanted to create the world, he told the Sarai Shel Yam, the Lord of the sea, to swallow in the waters that were covering the land. And Rashi adds, "Kedei sheteiroe hayabosha," so that the yabosha, the dry land, be seen. Rashi uses the language of Yom Hashlishi of creation. Vayomer Elokim yikavu amayim tachas hashamayim el mokom echad v'seiroe hayabosha, and the Lord of the sea, the Saro Shel Yam, refused. And the Gemara of there ends that HaKadosh Baruch Hu boad boy, he stomped the Saro Shel Yam and he killed him. And then he created the Yabosha. The Gemara brings a verse in Sefer Iyov where it says, "Bechoy choy roga hayom uvisvunosoy mochatz rahav." With his strength, he quietened the sea, and with his wisdom, he quashed rahav. And the Gemara ends over there in the name of Rabbi Yitzchak. From this we learn that the name of the Lord of the Sea, Sarish Shalyam, is Rahav. Rahav means pride. Who is this Rahav? Who is this Mr. Pride? Was the Chas V'Shalom another power besides the Creator of heaven and earth, whom God had to fight against in order to establish the world as we know it? Other cultures believed foolishly in a multitude of gods, Elohim Acherim, and they had their Poseidon and the like, lords of the sea and what the seas and whatnot. But we, who, those of you who davened Ma'ariv already said Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. I didn't yet, and I'll say later this evening Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. We know there's only one God. So who is this Rav guy? Who is this Sarai Shalyam? This is the difficult Gemara. Let me go back to the experience I have coming back to Yeshiva Sribitz Kalchanan. It's a nostalgic experience for me, because my father-in-law, Reb David Lifshitz, served here for about 50 years. And many times I would visit here, and I was invited to say shir on one of the lower floors in this building. And in this nostalgic mood, I'd like to go back to my father, who was also mentioned in the introduction. He was the world recognized Gaon, who died in 1986. And I want to go back to a particular time in my father's life. He visited Israel for his first time in 1956. He was 65 years old then. He was considering retirement in Eretz Israel. My mother had died 2 years earlier, and alone and somewhat depressed, he considered settling in Israel and becoming a private citizen in the relatively new Jewish state. In Jerusalem, a peer of my father's from Slabodka Yeshiva, gynecologist Dr. Dov Shapiro, he was someone who wanted to become a doctor, and his parents wouldn't hear of it until he went to ask the Rogatchover to speak to his parents that should let him become a doctor. And this Slabodka Talmid became a gynecologist. And he had been living in Eretz Yisrael. First he was in America, then he had been living in Eretz Yisrael already at that time. And he talked my father out of it, out of settling in Eretz Yisrael then. He convinced him to return to Brooklyn, where he still had many years of productivity ahead. After his 1956 visit, my late father served as a Shashiva and Sivza Torah Vadas for another 11 years. He took over the leadership of the Haredi sector of American Orthodoxy after the death of his Slabodka bosom friend, Rabban Kotler, in 1962. He served as Doyen of American Gdolim after his retirement from Torah Vadas of Brooklyn to Muncie in 1967 for another 18 years. There was no need for him to retire. Dr. Shapiro was right. Furthermore, my father could not have retired at that age, because his mind was too creative and his personality too effervescent to sit back and let the world go by him at the age of 65. I elaborated a bit about my father because today happened to have been his yahrzeit, his 19th yahrzeit. We can conjecture what would have happened had he settled in Israel in 1956. One thing I could say, I could guess would have not happened, I would not have become a famous man and been invited to be a guest speaker here, because making of a gadol would not have been banned, even if written as it was 18 years or 17 years after his demise, because my father would have spent his last 30 years of his life, from 56 to 86, teaching the truth need not be hidden. The Lithuanian Gdolim never hid the truth about themselves, because they had nothing to be ashamed of, not their struggles and not their human side, the being human rather than angelic, having symbolized truth, honesty and humaneness. My father would have educated a generation of Haredim in Eretz Yisrael that there's nothing wrong with a book like Making of a Gadol. Something else would not have happened had my father moved to Israel then. There would not have been an issue issued both on the books and the person of Rabbi Nassim Slifkin, an expert in zoology and philosophy. I will explain why no such issue would have been promulgated. Unlike my book, which being in English was not read at all by the Gdolim, in fact the published ban on my book reads Nizdazanu lishmoa mipi tamidei chachamim ne'amonim. We, the undersigned Gdolim, were shaken to hear from the mouths of reliable Torah scholars that such and such book is full of severe degradation, debasement, humiliation, and defamation of some of our great holy teachers. They heard about it from reliable Torah scholars. The signatories could not read the book in the foreign language and relied on people who happened to be totally unreliable. And I was never spoken to about my book. But, unlike my book, a few lines of the Slifkin book was read by one authority, and he writes in translation, as one who knows the English language, I can testify that a Talmud Chacham who is concerned about the honor of the Torah and the faith came to me. I'll stop quoting here, because I too am concerned with the honor of Torah and faith, and so was Rabbi Slifkin when he wrote his books. But let me continue reading what that English reading authority wrote. I can testify that a Talmud Chacham was concerned about the honor of the Torah and the faith came before me and showed me books authored by one named Nosson Slifkin, which actually make the hair stand on end from what I read therein. He believes that the world is millions of years old, earth to his mouth, feh, and such things that one is not permitted to hear and certainly to believe. Let me first share with you something that I write on page 680 of Making of a Gadol, and I quote, a basic doctrine in the creed of Lithuanian Gdolim is 'tis better than the faith of many be flawed than even a few be hurt. And I prove it from certain events. In the case of the Zoo Rabbi, Nassim Slifkin, this doctrine was not adhered to, because the Litvak does not deem it better to hurt someone than to believe that the world is millions of years old. I'm not, chas v'shalom, speaking about hurting someone and not believing the Torah is min hashamayim, that the Torah is absolutely true, but about hurting someone and believing that the Torah does not say that the world is not millions of years old. It is the opinion that the world is not millions of years old one of the 13 principles of faith? Because if these Gdolim expound that it is a principle of the Jewish religion, we are in very serious trouble indeed. Let me explain. The Rambam writes in the third chapter of his Yad HaChazaka that the moon is not a body of mundane, that is a celestial matter, but a living and knowing thing. When Neil Armstrong walked on the moon on July 20th, 1969, my father, living in Muncie already, sought out a neighbor who owned a television set in order to watch Armstrong walk on the moon. And next time his Talmidim came to hear a shiur from him, he began as follows. You probably did not see the moon landing, but how could I not see it? When what my father saw clashed with the Rambam's exposition, my father decided that the first three chapters of the Rambam are not based on Chazal, on the words of the sages, but on Greek philosophers, and they were wrong. So much for my father's approach. Recently, a young man from England spoke to my oldest son, Reb Yosef, and he told him that the entire moon landing was only staged. He proved it because the American flag that Armstrong planted didn't hang down limply as it should have in an airless atmosphere where there is no wind. It was distended. He didn't know that a wire had been inserted inside the flag so that the stars and stripes be seen. Now, it's very easy to deny reality and say things are staged. Carbon dating that prove that rocks are more than 6,000 years old are staged. Fossil findings that indicate the world is millions of years old are staged. Astronomical computations that show that the Big Bang occurred billions of years ago are staged. Because if things are staged, we can avoid facing difficult problems and trying to discover valid solutions, as Rabbi Slifkin has done. But if all these things are not staged, as they indeed are not, and we consider the belief that the world is only something like 6,000 years old, a principle of Jewish faith, we are in very serious trouble. Very serious trouble indeed. Our faith is anachronism. Chas v'shalom. It is the honor of the Torah and the faith that Slifkin set out to uphold. And that is what compelled him to write his books. If my father, who went to watch the moon landing, how could he not go see it? If he would have settled in Israel in 1956, he might have had a following in the Haredi community, which would then not have condemned Slifkin, but appreciated and thanked him. But due to Dr. Shapiro, my father did not move to Israel, and the situation there is unfortunately as it is. It's just a lesson that a man should never consult a gynecologist. It is extremely interesting that those who claimed I was embarrassing the Gdolim of yore are the very ones who embarrassed them by insinuating that the truth about the Gdolim is an embarrassment for them. Aren't they saying that if you know the truth about those Gdolim, they will turn out small men? Which is absolutely false, because knowing the truth about them makes them even greater. Likewise, those who contested Nosson Slifkin in the name of the honor of the Torah and the faith are the very ones who are dishonoring it by leaving questions on its veracity, instead of answering these questions, as Slifkin has done. In both cases, mine and Rabbi Slifkin, we can apply the rule of the Gemara in Kiddushin, kol ha-posel b'mumah posel. The fault that the detractor hurls at the other is the fault that the detractor himself is burdened with. Let me go back to my father's 1956 visit. He was enthused with Eretz Yisrael, and he wrote inspired letters to his children, all of whom lived in America at the time. In one letter he wrote as follows: "Sitting here atop the Carmel Mountain and looking down at the bay, verses in Tanakh become clear to me. For example, when the prophet Hosea says, 'Mo'ese lecho Ephraim, Mo'ese lecho Yehuda, v'chazdechem ka'anan boker, v'chatal mashkim holeich.'" Hosea is speaking to both Jewish kingdoms, the 10 tribes and Judea, and he says, "What shall I do with you, Ephraim?" The 10 tribes. "What shall I do with you, Yehuda, if your loyalty is like a morning cloud, and as the dew it is gone in the early day?" And my father writes, "I never understood what a morning cloud is, because in Europe or in America he didn't see it, until I saw it appearing on the horizon of Haifa Bay, which as the sun warms, the cloud disappears." The cloud is formed on the horizon, then it disappears. This is what the prophet compares the fickleness of Ephraim and Judea. My father, from experiencing this sight, understood Pshat and Apostolic in Hosea. My father taught me by that letter that one may learn Pshat in the Torah from one's observations of nature. And in the spirit of my sainted father's teaching, I too, by observing vicariously by way of the media the tsunami which hit Southeast Asia, I was able to understand the Gemara in Bava Basra, the difficult Gemara that I quoted at the beginning of my, shall I say, lecture or shir. The strange story of Rahab, the Lord of the Sea. As I mentioned, Rashi uses in Bava Basra, explaining God's order to Rahab that he swallow the sea, "Kedei shetiroa hayabosha." Rashi borrows the description of the Torah, the third day of creation. I'll repeat the pasuk: Vayomer Elohim, Yikavu hamayim mitachas hashamayim el mokom echad. And God said, "Let the waters from under the heavens be gathered into one place, that the dry land be seen," and it was so. Applying the rule of the Gemara of the Yerushalmi Masechet Rosh Hashanah, which declares, "Divrei Torah aniim bimkaimon vashirim bimokim acher," the words of Torah are poor in their place and rich in other places. By applying this rule, we can search out other sources in Tanakh where we see that the verse in Sefer Bereishis, more than it reveals, it covers up. When God announces, "Vayomer Elohim Yikavu Amayim," it was not all that simple. The verse in Baruch Nafshi Tehilim Kuf Daled, which describes the creation of the world, says expressly that it wasn't simply God said. I'll translate those several psukim. "Thou hast founded the earth upon its bases, that it should not be moved for all eternity. Thou covered the earth with vast waters as a garment. On the hills waters stood. Then from thy rebuke they, the waters, fled. From the sound of thy thunder they hastened. They ascended mountains and descended valleys to the place which thou founded for them. In the light of this these psukim and tehillim, when we read the pasuk in Bereishis, Vayomer Elokim, God said, Tehillim enriches this pasuk which was poor until the revelation of Sefer Tehillim, that God did not merely say Vayomer Elokim, He shouted at the waters, He rebuked them, He ordered them that they go to the place set aside for them. Yikovu amayim, let the waters be gathered in. And Tehillim reveals they didn't just vayichein, they were there. The pasuk says they fled, they hastened, they rushed over hill and dale to the place He founded for them. But these Maisa Bereishis events were even more dramatic than the Psukim in Tehillim Kuv Dalet. This is the Gemara in Bava Basra, based on the Pasuk in Iyov. God didn't merely say to the waters, He didn't just shout at the waters, rebuke them. He quashed and stomped the Lord of the sea, and then dry land was seen. Thus, when the Cheder child reads in his sing song, Vayomer Elokim, and God said, Yikovu Hamayim, let the waters be gathered in, Vayhi Chein, and so it was. It wasn't just so. The Lord of the sea had to be killed before the water obeyed. And it was so. And the conflict between the Sarah Shayam and God, as it were, is not only referred to in the book of Iyov, but in other verses in Tanakh. Tomorrow morning we won't say the Yom. If you do like the Zimla Gohan, you will just say Tehillim Kuv Dalet. But in the Yom, Kapitel Tzadigimel, or we say Hashem Moloch Geus Lovish, you don't say it in the morning, but you'll say it tomorrow evening after Mizmor Shel Yom HaShabbos. Hashem Moloch Geus Lovish, Lovish Hashem, Oizi Sazo. God reigneth, He has clothed Himself with pride, for he established a world Baltima that is not unstable. Firm is thy throne from the beginning. The streams have raised their voices, they raised their waves, but more powerful than the sound of the great waters, the mighty billows of the sea, is God on high. The psalm refers to the battle of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Lord of the sea, who refuses to allow a stable world by sending streams of mighty billows to wrap the hills and high ground like a garment. But God overcomes him. This Mizmor and Tehillim dramatizes the refusal of the Sovei Shalyam to swallow in the sea, and ends the story with God's overpowering Rahab's mighty billows. Let me cite one more source in Tanakh which repeats this drama. It's a pasuk you may recall from the introductory verses of Slichos, where a passage in Tehillim 74, Tehillim Ayin Dalet, is quoted, Mizmer Le'osof. It reads like this: Ad Mosai Elohim Yechoref Tzor Yinatz Oyev Shimcho LeNetzach. How long, O God, will the enemy insult the Jewish people? How will he will he blaspheme thy name forever? Why have you drawn back both thy hands? Pull out thy hand from thy bosom and destroy. O God, thou art my king from ancient times, who works salvation in the midst of the world. And here's the verse from Slichos. Ata porarta be'oz chayom, shibarta roshi taninim alamoim. With thy power thou crumbled the sea, the Lord of the sea. Thou smashed the heads of the gigantic sea creatures on the water. This verse refers again to God's might in the ancient times of the world's creation, when the mighty Lord of the sea, Rahav, together with his ocean creatures, were quashed and crumbled by God. And Osof invokes God, who was mighty enough to do all that, to silence and destroy the enemy who blasphemes God's name and insults God's people Israel. Of course, all this does not help us understand all these references to Sarei Shalyam. But as I said, thanks to the world-shaking event of the tsunami, when the voice of the streams of water reverberated throughout the world, Nosu Nehoris Kailam Yisu Nehoris Dokyam, the tempestuous streams raised their voices, the mighty billows of the billowing waves rose high. Like my father who learned Pshat in the Pesuk in Hosea, when he overlooked the Bay of Haifa, island Pshat in the mysterious Sarei Shalyam. Let me introduce my Pshat by telling you something that I checked into regarding the last major earthquake in Eretz Israel. About 8 weeks ago, I read this little sefer, Karnos HaMizbeach. It was written by a great Talmud Chacham, a Goyen who knew the Yonim of Seder Kodshim well. His name was Reb Yochel Sova. He was a Rav in Poland who was on intimate terms with the Chafetz Chaim. Reb Yochel was probably in his 60s when he died in 1929, 4 years before the nonagenarian Chafetz Chaim passed away in 1933. You know that since the turn of the 20th century, about the last century ago, 100 years ago, the Chafetz Chaim kept speaking about the coming of Mashiach and the halachic implications of such an eventuality. They were on his mind. He promoted the study of Seder Kodshim. He wanted Kohanim to become knowledgeable in how to bring the korbanos, the sacrifices in the Beis HaMikdash, which is soon to be rebuilt when Mashiach arrives. And the Chafetz Chaim writes that according to the strict halacha, in spite of our being defiled nowadays for the lack of the ashes of the Parah Aduma, the red heifer, with which to cleanse ourselves of our defilement, the defilement we have contracted, the tumah, from the corpses and from the graves and the like. But he writes that even in defilement, the Chafetz Chaim says, we are permitted to bring the korban al sibur, the public offerings, the korban Pesach, even in our time, even before Mashiach comes. Because in order to bring these offerings, we don't need a Beis HaMikdash. All we need is a Mizbeach, an altar, the altar in its place. But the Chafetz Chaim writes, there are 5 halachic impediments to our being able to bring these korbanos in practice. The first problem is that the Mizbeach must be built in its exact original location. So one problem is, how do we determine exactly where the Mizbeach stood in the Beis HaMikdash, on the Temple Mount? The second problem is, how do people who are defiled as we are, how do we enter the grounds of the temple in order to build the Mizbeach? The third problem is, whether the family lineage of the Kohanim nowadays is reliable enough to allow them to be makriv a korban. Because if a non-Kohen is makriv a korban, it's a cardinal sin. The fourth problem is with the special clothing a Kohen must wear to be makriv the korbanos. And one of the articles of clothing is the avne, the girdle that the Kohen wears, and it's supposed to have the tchelis in it. That's how we paskin. And we don't know exactly how to dye to produce the tchelis dye in our day. And the last problem the Chofetz Chaim has, the fifth one, pertains to the Ian of Ritzui Tzitz, that the Kohen Gadol's tzitz that he wears on his forehead, is maybe it's necessary in order for a carbon, even a carbon tzibur, to be brought betuma and defilement. We won't go into this point. Comes Reb Yochel Sova in this little book. He publishes this in 1928, a year before he died, and he outlines solutions for each and every one of the Chofetz Chaim's problems. And therefore he concludes, we are able to bring the public sacrifices and the Korban Pesach in our day and age. How does all this connect to the last major earthquake in Eretz Yisrael? I'll tell you. In his introduction, he writes the following. Pesach Dovo, an introduction. He writes, we heard about the great miracle which occurred now to all the Jews residing in Eretz Yisrael, where there was an earthquake. May the compassionate ones spare us. Rachmana litzlan. Where there was an earthquake there in a frightening and terrifying manner. It caused destruction which included hundreds of dead and wounded. And our mouths are full of praise to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, who saved all the Jews without exception in all areas where the earthquake struck. Likewise around the Kotel HaMaravi, although the quake was very severe and many houses there were demolished, yet the Holy One, blessed be He, saved the Kotel that not one pebble fell to the ground, as is well known throughout the world. Therefore we, who inherited the faith of Moshe Rabbeinu, let us go in his footsteps to arouse the great men of our nation in Eretz Israel and abroad to affix the Mizbeach and to prepare it. For our hope is strong that now the Yishmaelites, the Arabs, who presently tread upon and rule the site of the Mizbeach, will not hinder us. Chil ochaz yeshve ploshes. Fear, a trembling has seized the dwellers of Palestine. This is what he writes. Therefore, it is no time to tarry and be silent, as everyone understands. He wrote this in 1928. When I read these words, I immediately decided to find out exactly when this earthquake occurred. To paraphrase my father, Zichrono Livracha, how could I, a quasi-historian, not find out when this earthquake took place? I realized that it had occurred sometime, and not long, before the 1928 publication of the Yochel Sova Sefer. But exactly when? I began searching for old Jerusalemites. You know that my book, Making of a Gado, is primarily based on interviews with people. So I decided I'm going to find an old Jerusalemite who remembers those years not so long ago. Especially for someone like myself who's in the 70s already. I began searching for someone who might remember the events of the 1920s. On a Friday at noontime, I unearthed a treasure. I came across a little old lady named Fagi Freund, who sits in a 12 square meter delicatessen store in the Shuk of Mea Shoren, while her middle aged son attends the Lechvot Shabbat customers. After buying a container of her marinated herring, I asked the old lady if she knew anything about an earthquake in the 1920s in Jerusalem. And Fagi Freund immediately replied, "Of course I remember it. I remember it very clearly, because I was 5 years old, lying in bed with measles, when suddenly the ground shook, and the two walls, adjoining walls of a corner of the room, opened up and immediately closed again. I saw it with my own eyes." I then whispered to her son behind the counter and asked, "Which year was your mother born?" It was 1922, which means that the earthquake occurred in 1927. The son added that he knows someone born in Adar of 1927, so he's 78 years old now, whose parents told them that when he was exactly 4 months old, in a crib, the tremor threw over a closet onto his crib and just missed him. Thus I discovered that the earthquake occurred in Tammuz of 1927. I corroborated all this proof by looking at the Encyclopedia of Eretz Yisrael, and I found that in Tammuz of 1927 there was a severe earthquake in Eretz Yisrael. Another story I heard about the earthquake was connected with Dr. Ticho, a famous Jerusalem eye doctor whose wife was the Israeli artist Anna Ticho. The ophthalmologist had gone into an Arab house in the old city to attend a patient, and in the middle of the examination he excused himself. He needed a toilet. In those days there was outhouses in the yard for such needs. He left his doctor's kit in the patient's room and walked out of the house, and as soon as he stepped over the threshold, the earthquake struck. The house caved in, killing many of its Arab inhabitants, and crushed his medical instruments in his bag too. And the surviving family of those Arabs were out to avenge the blood of their relatives to kill Dr. Ticho, because they were sure that the Jewish physician had left the house because he knew an earthquake was about to strike, and he walked out without warning the people inside. Reb Zvulun Zak, a grandson of Reb Yaakov Moshe Chalap, prime Talmud of Rav Kook, told me there were cases where Jews and Arabs lived in one apartment house and the Arabs died while the Jews survived. It is little wonder that Rav Yaakov Sava imagined naively that the Yishmaelites will allow the Jews to build an altar on the Har HaBayis. Chil ochaz yeshvei ploshes. What am I driving at? It is the wish of people to see in a catastrophic event such as that earthquake the hand of God. There was some purpose on behalf of God's people in what Reb Yaakov Sava saw. It was obvious that God was directing the cataclysmic event, and its purpose, according to Rav Sova, was to rebuild the Mizbeach. This leads us to the tsunami. Should we not look for the Hashgacha of God in this earth-shaking event too? Of course, as faithful Jews, we know there is Hashgacha in every event, when we have no choice but to try to discover exactly for what purpose the tsunami occurred. Harav Chaim Kanievsky, the son of the disciple of Gaon, was reported in a newspaper article to have quoted the famous Gemara in Yevamos, "Ein puronus bo la'olam ela b'shvil Yisrael." Punishment does not come to the world but for Israel. And he explained that tsunami occurred as a warning to us Jews to beware and to better our ways in order to ensure that such punishment is not meted out to us. This is what the Gemara says. When Toronis happens to Masa'olam, and the Gemara brings a pasuk in Tzfanya, it's an order to send a message to God's people, to us Jewish people. Rabbi Leib Steinman, who has replaced Rav Shach in the Israeli yeshiva world, also spoke in the same vein. Let me define this type of approach and show its weakness when trying to apply it to the tragedy in Southeast Asia. As we prepare for Pesach, Mishenichnas Ador, so Rashi says in Masechas Tainis, Mishenichnas Ador, Yemei Nisim Hoyu LeYisrael, from Ador Purim uPesach. Mishenichnas Ador goes on, Purim all the way to Pesach. So tonight's the right night to mention the Haggadah. The Haggadah tells that the 10 plagues that were wrought on the Egyptians, the 10 Makos in Mitzrayim, were delivered with God's finger, Etzba Elohim. While the punishment the Egyptians suffered at Yam Suf were delivered with God's entire hand, Vayal Yisrael Hayod Agdolah. So there were not 10 makos, but 50 makos. Rabbi Shimon Rom, who taught probably in this building, interpreted this chazal very beautifully when he said, with a finger one warns. With a hand, one strikes. The makos, the plagues in Mitzrayim, they were a mere warning to the Egyptians. On the Red Sea, God struck. According to Rav Chaim Kanievsky, what happened in Southeast Asia, the horrendous punishment, was of course the hand of God. For what purpose? So that the finger that I attended 7 weeks ago, an old Jerusalem Jew, if Dr. Weitzman would have known this Gemara and Yevamos were not anti-Semites, blame Klal Yisrael for the suffering of Goyim, but Chazal do, he wouldn't have given the example that he did. But we in our day all know that not only was Dr. Weitzman's example wrong, so was his entire thesis. Because even with the Jewish homeland, anti-Semitism has not ceased to exist, as we all know. All is good and fine. As Rav Kanievsky and Rav Simon said, God used his hand to strike at the Goyim in order to shake his finger at us Jews. But I ask, should not there be some proportion between the hand of God and his finger? Wouldn't 20,000 Asians be enough of the hand of God to create the finger on our behalf? Couldn't we Jews see the very same warning, the finger of God, if only 30,000, 40,000, 50,000 nations, all created the Tzelem Elohim in the image of God, if they were lost? But for God's sake, why 200,000? And if the hand of God must be outstretched in order to show his finger to Israel, why Asians who never did any harm to Jews? Why not Europeans who killed out 6 million of our brethren? Let the hand of God strike them and we would gain the same warning. Are there no tectonic plates underneath the European continent to tremble and shake and destroy 200,000 Germans and their helpers? Are there no germs in the air above Europe to rain down a plague on the Europeans for the new anti-Semitism? How I wait to see the fulfillment of the penultimate message of God to Klal Yisrael through Moshe Rabbeinu in Parshas Hazinu. Ki Yisrael Shemayim Yodi V'amarti Chai Anochi La'olam Im Shanoi Si B'chak Harbi. For I lift up my hand to heaven and say, says God, as I live forever I will wet my glittering sword and my hand will take hold of judgment. I will render vengeance unto my enemies, and those that hate me will I requite. I will intoxicate my arrows from blood, and my sword shall devour flesh from the blood of the slain and the captives, from the crushed head of the enemy. And Moshe Rabbeinu ends the song of Azinu with his own message. Haninu goyim amo, speak aloud, ye nations, the praise of God's people. For the blood of his servant shall he avenge, vengeance shall he render to his adversaries, and shall forgive his land and his people. How I long to see Berlin and the other German cities destroyed. Could not God reveal his hand in judgment upon the Arab gangsters in Gaza, Yehudah v'Shomron, destroy 200,000 of them? Wouldn't the finger of God be more effective if shaken not thousands of miles away, but near us, near Sderot, near Gush Katif, near Jerusalem? I don't think the Gemara in Yevamos applies to the catastrophe in Southeast Asia. Bimchilas kvod Torah hagdolim haim. It was not the hand of God creating a finger for us which raised the waves in the Indian Ocean. The hashgacha of HaKadosh Baruch Hu and the tragedy of Southeast Asia is indeed inexplicable. But as a faithful Jew, I believe wholeheartedly that there was hashgacha. I just don't see it. I just don't understand it. I'd rather say I don't know why God did what he did than give an inadequate interpretation of it. But inasmuch as I believe in the hashgacha of God in everything else, I can live without finding an answer to the single question, why did God bring on this once in a century catastrophe in Southeast Asia? I know it was with hashgacha. I just cannot say why God wrought this cataclysm. And with this, I get back to Rahav, the Sori Shalyam, the Lord of the Sea. Imagine if such earthquakes happened every other day. Imagine if tsunamis kept on striking at odd places the world over. Imagine if the waves rushed and covered over hill and dale every few weeks. What conclusion would the human mind reach? We would say, obviously, there is no hashgacha over mankind. Nature acts as it wills, and there is no divine guiding force to bring purpose into creation. The human mind would deny God's supervision over what happens to mankind. Rahav is not an independent creature competing with God, chas v'shalom. The Soroi Shel Yam is a type of world in which we humans would be unable to grasp and perceive the hashgacha of God. And Chazal tell us that at the beginning of time, on the third day of creation, the earth was of such frailty and instability that cataclysmic events occurred without let up. And if they were to go on, the human being eventually to be created on the sixth day of creation would be blind to the hashgacha of God. I would add that it is the human pride, the human desire to be independent and unshackled of the constraints of providence, that blinds a person to submitting to God's rule and hashgacha over him. And if we somehow yet manage to subdue our pride and see the functioning of hashgacha in our lives, it is only because we humans are able to plan our lives, to know what to expect. Our pride would never allow us to see God running a world where nature runs amok. A world in which human beings count for so little. Here a tornado knocking him over. Here an earthquake shaking him up. Here a volcanic eruption covering him with lava. Here a tsunami drowning him. A world in a constant state of upheaval. A seemingly random world is called Soroi Shel Yam. And God needed to transmute his original creation and call on stability to take over, so that despite his pride, Adam HaRishon should be able to say, there is hashgacha over me. This change from a wild world to a stable one is described in Baba Basra as the stomping and eradication of the Lord of the Sea. And now, after the Sarah Shalyam is gone and done away with, if man only wills it, he can see God running the world with purpose, with destination, with Hashgacha. And if a tsunami occurs once in 100 years and floods hundreds of villages and annihilates myriads of human beings and wreaks havoc among millions, we can still maintain our faith and say, we don't know what God wanted this time, but aware of the constant Hashgacha, we have full faith that in this tsunami too, there was purpose. Hashgacha rules the world, not Sarei Shalyam. We should just add to the tsunami story, Hashem Yirachem, Rechmon Litzlan, may the compassion to one spare us. On the contrary, because unlike what the Rav Kanievsky and Rav Steinman said, that they can see what the purpose is, because we cannot see what the purpose is, that is what Sarei Shalyam is. If it happens once, doesn't matter. But if it happens constantly, as on the third day of creation, we could never accept Hashgacha. Our pride certainly would not allow us to. I'll end my talk tonight with a few words that I feel are profound enough to be appreciated by yeshiva audience. I mentioned the Yerushalmi that states the Torah words are poor ad locatum in their place and enriched by other sources. The example I gave is how the verse describing God's creation of dry land on the third day is expanded upon in other verses in Tanakh. If we are true ma'aminim and ohavi Torah, we ought to be thrilled to have discovered via those extraneous psukim a better understanding of the verse in Bereishis. If we would have read that verse alone, we would have been wrong in understanding it. Vayomer Elokim Yikov HaMayim, God said in the heaven. But thanks to all those other psukim, we know the truer pshat in these psukim. I'm sure you are familiar with the idea expressed in Medrash Rabbah at the beginning of Bereishis, beginning of Medrash Rabbah. The exact text over there is, HaKadosh Baruch Hu Mabit B'Torah U'Borei Yisraelim. The Holy One, bless thee, looks into the Torah and creates the world. The Torah was the blueprint for the creation. And the Holy One, bless thee, read in the Torah, Bereishis Bara Alkim Ezashmayim Vesoret, then he went ahead and created Eretz V'Shamayim. Now imagine yourself taking a course in how to read architectural blueprints proficiently. You have in front of you a building with the blueprints by which it was built. And you can compare the blueprints with the building and therefore become knowledgeable and efficient in how to read blueprints. Imagine if you were taking a course in how to read blueprints and someone whispers to you, you know, this blueprint, this and this building was built based on these blueprints. So now you can figure out exactly how to read the blueprint. And that would enable the student to pass the course. We all are taking a course in reading blueprints. It's called the Mitzvah of Talmud Torah. We read the Psukim, and we're supposed to understand the Psukim. And by looking at the world, we can understand the Psukim better. By looking at the building, we understand the blueprint. The blueprint. By the truer understanding of the world, we know a truer understanding of the blueprint. We find out that the reading Vayiyere Vayivoke Yom Echad means something other than it was morning and evening one day. It has another deeper meaning, thanks to science. Should we not be grateful to science that it enabled us to understand better, more truly, the creation of the world, and therefore gain a better understanding of the blueprint of creation. This is Talmud Torah. We ought to be thankful. We ought to be thrilled that the Torah we are learning, which is poor in the verses of creation, has become enriched, asher mimokom acher, enriched through Mada. Don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying you should spend the hours and days of Mada to understand several psukim better. Instead of spending the hours and days on shas and posting, to use the terms at the end of the third perek in Pirkei Avos, it is certainly better to spend your time on gufei halachos than on parparos lachochma. But we as believers, as Torah lovers, should we not be appreciative of Mada when it helps them to understand the pasuk in a truer manner? Rashi, at the beginning of Shir HaShirim, draws the parable of a woman exiled from her husband for a long time. As she longs to return to the kisses of her husband's mouth, Yishokeini minishiko spiru. And Rashi declares, this is a paradigm for Klal Yisrael. Having received the Torah, when God spoke to us face to face, lips to lips, and that love is still dearer to us than any other pastime, this is our love for the study of Torah. Rashi, the Mefarsh of Rashi, is just the man to say this. We are assured by God, Rashi goes on, that He will appear again to us to explain Sod Torah, the secrecy of its meanings, Umistar Tzfunoseo, and the mystery of its enigmas. And we beseech God that He fulfill His word, Yishokeini min shikai spiu. We long to be kissed with the kisses of God's lips, with the revelations of the Torah words, which we enjoy more than any other pastime. Perhaps the discoveries of science, by science, of secrets of creation of the universe, is God's way of reappearing to us and explaining the secrecy of the Torah's meanings, the mystery of its enigmas. And this is what we long for such a long time. Thank you.
If anybody has any questions, Rav Kamenetsky will take a few questions. Yoel will go around with the microphone. Please say your name before. Oh.
My name is Rabbi J. Miller, and I think one of the most pleasurable 2 or 3 years of my life was being associated with Reb Dassin as the Rosh Yeshiva, in which I said a shir in. And I would just like to point out 2 things to the tzibur of how this was what I would call typical Reb Dassin. Number one, in the reading of that Rashi, right, the his saying of the words v'siyeroya hayabosha, right, turn this side, this is only miktash. This will be miktash bracha. That when Reb Dassin heard the words v'yeroya hayabosha, v'siyeroya hayabosha, and his ear, that's ozen milim gibbon, that the ear grasps words, and Reb Dassin grasped the words of the Rashi. He has this phenomenally acute ear and grasped the words of Rashi, and that he made the switch to, he made the move to Maisa Breshis, where it says the Sevra HaYabosha, on the basis of that phenomenal ear that he has, right? That's something that I would identify this Bar Torah as his from anybody, right? That's number one, right? 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 That's number one.
I'm hard of hearing compliments.
Number two, the ability to bring together a pasuk from Breishi, a pasuk from Breishi, a pasuk from Tehillim, another pasuk from Tehillim, Another pasuk from over here. An interview with an old lady. Hakdama to a sefer hakotchim. Right? Hakdama to a sefer hakotchim. A report from an encyclopedia. Here, and here. Right? Now again, right? That combination of Iluyishkeit and method, right? Iluyishkeit and method, that is completely redundant. And believe it, right?
Who are you talking about?
I'm talking about the man that we hired to learn to teach the students who had only had two previous years of Gemara learning experience, right? And here all of a sudden, they themselves, after a while, were able to learn the Rashba, were able to learn the Rabban, were able to learn the Pnei Yoshua, and I could see them clustering around Reb Nosrat, asking him a kasha. He's standing around the bima which they read the Torah, and Reb Nosrat says, bring me a bit kaskido. So one of the Talmidim says, which Caleb? He says, it doesn't matter.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. This is one of the most easy questions that I've been fielded to me in all my lectures. On which?
Does the Rav believe that we can use science to reinterpret Psukim without a clear Mesorah from Chazal, or possibly even opposing Mesorahs from Chazal?
Do I believe that? Could you ask the question again?
Does the Rav believe that we can use the findings of science in Maaseh Bereishis to reinterpret or better understand the Pshat and Psukim without a clear Mesorah from Chazal?
I'll tell you, when my father looked over the Haifa Bay and he saw the morning cloud disappearing and he learned Pshat in the Pasuk in Hosea, he did not have a tradition of Mesorah of Chazal going down from the time of Hosea until 1956 to be able to interpret that Pasuk in Hosea by what he observed. So obviously I hold you can interpret a Pasuk without a clear Mesorah of Chazal. My father held that way too.
The Rav spoke about how the fact that the tsunami was in Southeast Asia as opposed to an enemy, that it's not really a finger shaking at us. It's something else that we can't understand. Well, that could be true, but had it been somebody, an enemy of the Jewish people who had been struck by this catastrophe, then wouldn't we think that it's not really a finger being wagged at us, it's like God helping us out? And we wouldn't even think of that. So the fact that it happened in a place where you have nothing to do with, it could be both. That
it's
both
a good point. Now, when the Gemara in Basra, it does say that HaKadosh Baruch Hu brings Puranos, Ba'olam, in order to warn Israel, don't forget the Chazal, the setting of this Chazal is where Eretz Yisrael is surrounded, the known world, at least the world known to Jews at that time, were people who were all against Israel. So therefore, the Puranos which strike them is deserving, but Chazal said even if these nations were not that bad to deserve all that punishment, but they were punished in order to they were struck in order to warn Jews. But they were enemies of ours, but not to that extent that they deserve to be wiped out. Now, you say that in our day and age, if such an event were to strike Germany, oh how I wish it! If such an event were to strike Germany, we wouldn't say it's a warning to us. We'd say it's simply a punishment to them. All right, let it be. I wouldn't mind.
Yes, I'm interested in knowing, you called the psukim in Brachos the poor psukim, while the psukim in the Tehillim Baruch Nafshi, the stronger psukim, or whatever, something to that extent. What exactly is the Lashon Kodesh that Chazal use for stronger, weaker, or good, or better?
The lashon that I quoted from Chazal is only divater aniim b'makamecha b'mkoimon v'ashirim b'makamecha. Aniyus and ashirus. That's the contrast between the two kinds.
Aniyus and ashirus.
Aniyus and ashirus.
Okay, thank you.
Yes.
You mentioned that if your father had made Aliyah in the 1950s, there might have been a more moderate Haredi faction in Eretz Yisrael.
I didn't use the word modern.
Okay, I'm saying a different faction. The question is...
Use the word truer.
What? A truer faction, okay.
Yeah.
Given the fact that someone like Professor Zalman already moved to Eretz Yisrael 20 years earlier and had founded the Chevron Yeshiva, and what do you think, and the values of the Haredi community in Eretz Yisrael are by and large a product of the Purushim ready from the 19th century, do you think it was viable that there could have been a different Haredi community in Eretz Yisrael now, or in Yerushalayim especially, you know, had someone like your father moved to Eretz Yisrael and created a community around him?
Do I believe it was possible?
Yeah.
Certainly I believe it's possible. I think it's even possible now. If some leader were to appear and speak his mind, and I'm trying to think back. Who was the one that told me? Maybe it was possibly here this evening that he told me, "Don't be concerned, Omnasim. Truth will win." Certainly, it's possible.
What?
Aha. Emes me'eretz titzmach. Even if the emes is down in the earth, it'll sprout up.
I was just wondering what the Rav's response was to, I mean, if the Rav ever engaged in a dialogue with the Gedolim that put the ban on his book, whether you ever discussed with them what your thoughts were, whether you tried to work out some kind of compromise.
I did mention that the Gedolim who outlawed my book just relied on what other people told them. They didn't read the book themselves, and I was never spoken to. Now, what was your question?
So, was there ever any dialogue at all between?
Was that?
Was there ever any dialogue between
no,
the Rav?
No, there was never any dialogue. No. There was only one person speaking, myself, trying to get permission to reprint the book, perhaps in an improved edition.
Does the Rav think that it would benefit the situation at all by actually engaging in a dialogue and trying to determine whether there could be some way of explaining to them what the Rav had in mind, his views?
I'll tell you, in order to facilitate that, you have to have two parties. You're reminding me of the peace process where Israel wants peace and the other side doesn't want. Well, you can only make peace between two people. I would love to engage in a dialogue. As a matter of fact, I was in Los Angeles when I printed my book. It came out Erev Rosh Hashanah, and 6 weeks later I left for California for health reasons. And it was when I was there that the Tumah started in Eretz Yisrael. And the main culprit, the main tumler, he had come to America then, and I challenged him. Then in Kalti, he was in Brooklyn then. I called from California. And I said, "Why don't you organize 500 B'nai Torah to sit and let's have a debate on the merits of my book?" And he turned me down.
Yes. I was just wondering, within most of our lifetimes in this room, the people who remember the true stories of the Gedolim won't be around anymore to write these books. So what can we do to preserve the truth about them? I mean, my kids will only be left with, you know, certain article stories that might not BSM mistake, or will it be lost to all time? It's a depressing thought.
Well, I will be speaking in the Borough Park this Mitzvah Shabbos. The topic they asked me to speak about over there is the making of a band. I'll tell you that the name of that topic is better than what Rabbi Bravender, whom Jay Miller mentioned earlier, he gave me to speak about the topic, how to write about Gdolim. I think that title wins the race. When I'll be speaking there, I'll touch on your on this point that you're mentioning.
You seem to be, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like you advocate the position that a non-Jewish life is worth less than a Jewish life, particularly those who were killed in the tsunami. If this is indeed your position, could you please explain why you feel this way?
The Chazal said that Poronus comes on the Umay Yisraelam in order to Bishvil Yisrael, in order to warn Israel. I mean, why do I feel this way? Because I know of the Kuzari that man is chosen over animals, and that's why animals can be used to serve man, and the Jewish people is the chosen people over all the other Umosalom, and therefore the Umosalom have a way of serving the more chosen people, then it's perfectly valid. I didn't say Atta V'chaitanu. Chazal said it.
The Rav mentioned the Slifkin controversy. I'm not going to get into that issue, but a large part of what he tries to do is explain Maimon Chazal and synthesize them with scientific evidence. The Rav synthesized them with scientific observation and evidence. How exactly does the Rav feel that the balance should be struck between science and Maimre Chazal? I mean, often science will be in conflict with Maimre Chazal, and here we're going to say, we're going to interpret Pesukim sometimes based on observing nature. But isn't there a difference between seeing a cloud and using that to interpret an ambiguous Pesuk and saying that all scientific observation need be in line with Torah? I mean, it's not the same.
Yeah. If you accept that the scientific observations are true, and you accept that the Torah is true, there cannot be a conflict between them. Exactly how to reconcile both things, I didn't read Slifkin's books. I just know the idea of his books, because I'm interested in other subjects. But the fact that you have to reconcile two truths is the truth must be reconciled with truth. There is no choice.
It's never irreconcilable, science and Torah.
What's that?
Rav is saying that it's never irreconcilable. Science and Torah are always. They may appear to be in conflict, but if we were able to really.
Absolutely. If it's true science.
How does the Rav understand the authority of a gadol to make a ban, and why doesn't the Rav republish his book without re-editing
it? I was asked this question on the way up with Menachem Butler, and I told him, I quoted a Sefer HaChinuch who says, on the question of Lo Soster Mekol Asher Yerucha, and Chazal say, even if they say on the right that it's left, on the left that it's right, the Ramban speaks about the Sanhedrin, and he says that they actually are never wrong. They're guided by heaven not to be wrong. But the Chinuch, I think the Chinuch is speaking about, he's writing the Sefer for people of his day. He's not speaking about the Sanhedrin, which sits in the Beis HaMikdash. And he's speaking about the leaders of Klal Yisrael. And he says that even if they are wrong, he says they can be wrong, even if they are wrong, we should still abide by the rulings, because it's better to abide, because they are generally right. So if you're going to not follow them in any specific thing, so you're undermining their entire authority, So it's not worthwhile to follow through on what you're right about, and in that way it destroyed the whole structure of the authority of the Gdolim. That's why I'm not republishing. What? This what? Yeah. Yes. I feel tonight like the magician who calls someone from the audience to come up and volunteer and hear the someone. What's that? I don't feel that way about myself.
Bereshus, everyone. Since the Rav likes contextualizing things in stories, so I was once on a flying back from Eretz Yisrael. I was sitting next to the Rav's brother-in-law, a noted sociologist, and he mentioned that he felt that over not even maybe the medium term, the Haredi community, for socioeconomic reasons, was not sustainable in the current model with so many batlanim and such large families, and that something would definitely have to change. And you expressed that you didn't really think there was change possible in the community. So I was just wondering if you could comment on if you mean the change can't come ideologically from the top down, but maybe from the bottom up, eventually things will inevitably have to change.
I agree with my brother-in-law on that this kind of a structure, it can't last. There has to be. I mean, people have to make a living, and they can't go and can't constantly marry other children by buying a ticket to the United States and going around collecting quarters at Mincha and Ma'ariv. Something will burst. As a matter of fact, there was a review of my book in Hamayan by Professor Breuer, and I do. Mentioned this point that eventually something will have to give.
Just going back to your book, I'm sure it was extremely difficult to decide when to say negative things about people that we look to for inspiration. Could you share a little bit about how you made the decision of when to say something somewhat negative, and how do we tweak and balance that in life when we want inspiration? How do we do that?
I'll tell you something. I didn't write anything negative about anyone in my book. If you say about someone that he's human, that's not Lashon Hara. That's not. The Chafetz Chaim seeks to find how can you speak Lashon Hara on a child, because whatever a child does is the human way of what a child does. So if you're going to say something that he did something wild, that's not Lashon Hara. That wouldn't be, because he did something human. If I describe the Gdolim as being human, I'm not finding fault with them.
How does Rav understand the Meiri who said that as long as people are Mugdaros, Umos HaMugdaros Badat, they are considered equivalent to Jewish people? And I think that Rav Kook also felt the same way. I think he wrote that. The Meiri said that as long as you've got people who are within the constrictions of a religion, then they're equivalent to the Jewish people insofar as how to deal with them and so on. Certainly that should apply to the Muslims in Southeast Asia. They are certainly monotheists. How do we understand that?
But I would say the question the other gentleman raised about the guy in my bed to serve Jesus, so on. So I wouldn't say going, then I would say pagans. You could still ask the same question. Do I feel, the other gentleman could ask the same question, do I feel that the pagans are any lower than Jews or than believers in religion? you'd still be faced with the same problem. You still have to come up with an answer, and either you say the not words or say the are, and I say the are.
I know the Rav did the research for the Art School Rabbi Yaakov book. I was wondering
about the book,
the book about your father that Art School published.
Yeah,
I was wondering if the Rav felt that that book was like other Art School biographies, or if that one did it have seem like.
Well, there were articles written by in the Jewish Observer by Rabbi Aaron Feldman. He writes specifically about the book Rabbi Yaakov, the Art School book, and he says that it's not of the same genre. Mm-hmm.
Does the Rav agree?
What's that?
Does the Rav...
Yeah, I'll tell you. When I gave the material to Art Scroll, so I told them to choose an author to make a book out of it. By the way, I collect royalties from the Art Scroll till this day on the Rav Yaakov book. The royalties they pay an author is 10%, so I get 5%, and Jonathan Rosenblum gets 5%, because I provided the material. Now, they happen to have selected Jonathan Rosenblum, who did an excellent job, and I'm very happy that it made him famous, because since he wrote that book, people realize that he's a man of great talent, and they've been utilizing it for good purposes. I feel that it's a much better cut, a much higher cut of the General Gdolim book.
You just mentioned that you'll be speaking on Motzei Shabbos at the Young Israel Bar Park with the title The Making of a Band. What time does that start?
That starts 8:45, and they put in the paper that they were going to charge $10 to enter. So you give refreshments for people that come, and they charge money.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Kamenetsky.
What's that?
There'll be a Marv on the third floor base medrash in 5 minutes. There will be a bus at 10 p.m. going to Midtown.